X marking his return this week in Orlando. After a nagging rib injury following the season-opening century, Xander Schauffele is gearing up for the Florida swing. How will the third-ranked player in the world look in his second PGA Tour start this young season? Coming off a win at the HSBC Women's World Championship, what's next for Lydia Ko? 23 career LPGA Tour wins, three majors, coming off one of the best years of her career. Can she follow it up with a big 2025? We'll discuss on the show. Plus, Maverick McNealy's been in full flight the past 4 months on the PGA Tour. His first win, and now he's all the way up to 12th in the official world golf ranking. How is he taking the next step with his game? We're going to hear from the man on this Tuesday edition of Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Let's have a day here on Golf Today. I'm George Savarikas, pleased to be sitting alongside Rex Hoggard here with you for the next couple hours. Bay Hill Week always has a special place in our heart here at Golf Channel. I know we already celebrated our 30th birthday at Golf Channel earlier this year, but especially when the HQ was down in Orlando, it felt like it was an annual reunion. Each and every year we were at Bay Hill, you'd get to walk around, you'd see AP, where he'd hang out, either in the clubhouse or his card room back there. What are the memories like when you would be on property going around Bay Hill?
It's my hometown event, and having the opportunity to now cover it for all of those years and having Arnold there was so special. We talked a little bit about this yesterday. The highlight of my year, really, as far as Wednesdays goes, was Wednesday of Bay Hill, because he would sit down and do the State of the Kingdom, and you could ask him anything, and he was so gracious with his time, and he pulled on so much knowledge that, I mean, let's face it, no one else has. He can, you know, connect generations between Ben Hogan and Tiger Woods. There's not many people that can do that.
I think you had mentioned it yesterday that Arnold would always have the golf bag on the golf cart.
Like he's ready to go.
Yeah, like who knows? Maybe if they get deep enough down the alternate list, the AP could have gotten inside the ropes one more time. So the PGA Tour's Florida swing, they're in Orlando this week, and the world's best are teeing it up in the Arnold Palmer Invitational. First round coverage gets underway Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern time, right here on Golf Channel. Here's a look at the upcoming schedule, and we got a doubleheader this week. Arnold Palmer Invitational, the signature event presented by MasterCard. I'll actually be on the call as part of the broadcast team for the Puerto Rico Open. Then we go the Players, the Valspar, closes out the PGA Tour's 4 weeks in Florida. The couple events before the Masters, Texas Children's Houston Open and Valero Texas Open, the Texas two-step, and then we embark on the season's first major. So as the PGA Tour's best prepare for another signature event, PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan met with the media this morning at Bay Hill, and our Todd Lewis is on site. Todd, what did you learn from that meet and greet with Jay Monahan?
Yeah, well, this is the first time that Jay Monahan has addressed the media since that Oval Office visit just a week and a half ago, where he and President Trump and Yasser Al-Rumayyan met to try to unify the game of golf. But the big message coming out of the commissioner today was the fact that there is a lot of positive energy when it comes to the PGA Tour. Now, this was brought up at the AT&T Pebble Beach, the PGA Tour announcing through its Fan Forward initiative, where they surveyed and polled thousands and thousands of fans, that they were starting to listen to those fans and trying to innovate the product here on the PGA Tour. And according to the tour, it's off to a strong start with double-digit improvement in the ratings this year with the network partners, a level of engagement on social media and other platforms that have increased. Corporate partnership has really been a positive for the PGA Tour. Over the last 3 months, they have created $400 million of new revenue with title sponsors. And we saw some of that last week with the announcement of Valspar extending its title sponsorship through the championship in the Tampa area. This week, 3M announcing its extension in Minnesota. And we're hearing that next week there will be more announcements of corporate sponsors continuing their relationship with the PGA Tour. And through this Fan Forward initiative, the tour has listened to fans and what they want on the broadcast. And we continue to see that with the cut line being the focus on Friday. This week, there's going to be more player caddy interaction that you will see on the broadcast, more data through the broadcast as well. And that's in cooperation with MasterCard, which is, of course, the title sponsor here. And then you talk about full swing season 3 coming out, TGL. There's a new broader audience that is coming to the PGA Tour. All in all, Jay Monahan was there to say that the tour is in a positive spot, has a lot of momentum in Q1 2025.
Todd, it seems like every other week we're trying to parse through the kernels of information we have and try and figure out, okay, what's the updated timeline for when a deal could come to fruition? Did you get any indication?
Well, Jay Monahan, of course, continues, and the tour continues to say they will not negotiate in public, and you understand that, but they did reveal that they continue to do some polling with the fans, and 70% of the fans that they talked to want a reunification in the game of golf. I did have a chance to talk to Jay Monahan in regards to that meeting and what dynamic President Trump brought to the negotiations, and he said, quote, "I don't think we would have the cadence or be in the position to get a deal done if not for the president, and I'm very thankful for him." Now, there are no scheduled in-person visits between the PGA Tour, the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, and President Trump, at least over the next few weeks. Now, of course, the PGA Tour is here this week. The Players, their crown jewel event, is next week. LIV has two events those same weeks as well, so nothing is scheduled. You will definitely hear nothing in regards to an announcement of a reunification or a deal over the next few weeks. But they continue to have some dialogue, although not in person, but we will see what happens over the next few weeks.
Todd, you mentioned next week's the flagship event, the Players Championship, and there will be a former LIV player playing in that championship. Lori Cantor earned enough points by winning on the DP World Tour to qualify for next week. I know the commissioner was asked about it this morning. What did he say?
He really kind of deflected his emotions and his thoughts in regard to Lori Cantor, who once played at LIV and now is going to be playing at the Players through his world ranking via the DP World Tour. He didn't really want to address that. He did say, why don't you talk to Lori Cantor in regards to playing in the Players next week? And I'm sure many media members will. As a matter of fact, the tour would probably do him a favor to hold a press conference. If not, it's going to be very challenging for him to prepare for a tough test of the Players, because a lot of writers will want to talk to him during practice rounds. But he did say that he is excited that he is in the field, and he's excited that he's a member of the DP World Tour. But that will be a bit of a buzz next week in Ponte Vedra Beach.
Yeah, certainly will be. Todd, appreciate it. We'll be back with you in just a minute. So with the Lori Cantor news and kind of the state of the PGA Tour with Commissioner Jay Monahan, we're in the information business trying to get access to those conversations, understandably so. Commissioner Monahan appears to be a bit reticent to completely let the media peek under the hood as far as how the conversations have progressed since that meeting in the Oval Office to where we are now, Rex.
And let's take it even further back. Let's go back to the framework agreement way back in June of 2023. The criticism back then, just not from the media, from the players, and certainly from the fans, was the idea that the tour did all this in secret, that there was no communication, that it felt like something was done below board, even though I'm sure it wasn't. In this particular case, now you fast forward and you have the commissioner talking, not just this week, but I was in Torrey Pines just a few weeks ago, and he held a very, very similar scrum, and he'll talk to the media again next week. This is all an effort to try to be as upfront and forward about this as possible. And I do appreciate the fact he is nothing if not consistent when he talks about, I'm not going to negotiate in public. You certainly understand how complicated this is. And you're right, though. We're going to continue to try to read between the lines as best we can. Don't do a very good job of it sometimes, to be quite frank, but we'll keep doing it.
It feels like, and this isn't with an insider take, that momentum is stalling a little bit from how bullish they were posturing publicly leading up to that Oval Office meeting.
And the commissioner was asked this morning, has the tone changed since that second meeting? And that was significant. That was a long time to spend in the Oval Office. It was over 3 hours. And you think to yourself, how did you not get something done, anything done, to walk out and have some sort of tangible evidence other than what you continue to fall back on, which is we're making progress, we're moving at speed, all of the things we've heard the commissioner say. To be fair to the PGA Tour, the governor of the Public Investment Fund has never spoken to the public about this. He does not have to. So Jay is in a very interesting, difficult position.
Lori Cantor playing next week. Positive, negative step, neutral?
I think it's a positive step because, again, you needed something to break the ice on this. And we've seen it. You go back to the Scottish Open last year. There was LIV players in that field. Certainly in the major championships. We have seen the LIV players, but this is significant because it's the flagship event. This is specific to the PGA Tour's crown jewel, as Todd Lewis said. And I think this could be a big step forward. You had to break the ice eventually, so why not make it Lloyd Cantor?
Makes sense to me. I mean, it's eventually going to happen, so why not start now with the players?
I think it's a good move. And look, he's a very good player. He's played well on the DP World Tour. I think it's pretty impressive. Now, let's go to this week's event. One of the headliners this week making his return to golf is Xander Schauffele, who would tee it up on the PGA Tour for the first time since the season-opening century in Maui. Xander has been battling a rib injury, which he suffered in the offseason. He is the world number three, and he's joined by the other four top five players in the world, including world number one Scottie Scheffler, who is the defending champion this week. There you see Rory, Ludvig Åberg, and Colin Morikawa, 45 of the top 50 players in the world, and three past champions, including Rory, Jason Day, and Scottie Scheffler. Now, while we have a chance talking about Xander Schauffele, let's send it back down to our very own Todd Lewis. Todd, what's the news on the world number three?
Yeah, first let's talk about what has happened to Xander Schauffele. Of course, he's coming off that really strong 2024, winning two majors. It seemed like that was going to be a launching point for him to have an incredible year. Of course, Scottie Scheffler was the player of the year, deservedly so, winning nine times worldwide. But Schauffele actually hurt his ribs late in 2024, his right side of his ribs, that soft tissue area, and decided to try to play through it at the Century. And he said that that was a mistake, because not only did he aggravate that soft tissue injury in his ribs, but also getting into some really uncomfortable swing habits. So after that, he decided to shut it down and really has taken his time to try to get himself ready for the PGA Tour. And finally, after some question as to when he was going to come back, maybe possibly right at Augusta National for the Masters, he is good enough to come back and compete here at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Now, we did see him play last night. Granted, he wasn't walking 18 holes, but he was playing in TGL, making some swings, and I actually watched that and didn't see any expressions of pain during his swings at that TGL match last night. And after competition, he talked about the fact that he is excited after what has been a frustrating last few weeks and months to get back to a high competitive level.
I miss being out and just sitting at home. You sort of appreciate a lot of things when you're sort of sidelined. So, you know, it was got some juices flowing, you know, even though you're hitting into a screen, still a bit nervous, just not really being competitive as of late. So I feel good and looking forward to getting over to Bay Hill.
And for him to return from a rib injury, this is going to be a tough test. Now, this course is very, very challenging. The greens are firm and the rough is going to be very hard. It's going to be at 4 inches to 4.5 by the weekend. So as he tries to dig it out of the rough, if he misses a fairway, we will see how that right side holds up. But Xander Schauffele, although not on the grounds yet to get ready for the Arnold Palmer Invitational, I've had some communication with him. He is excited to be back here on the PGA Tour. Guys?
Thank you, Todd, for all your insight. Don't go far. We're going to hear from you again. Stay close to that camera. Certainly, you look at what the frustration is that Xander has gone through. What wasn't frustrating is 2024. You look at his season review. Won two major championships, the PGA Championship and the Open. Three runner-up finishes, including a T2 at the Players, which should give him a lot of momentum going into next week. And then 15 top 10s in 22 starts. And here how you can watch Xander and the rest of the world's best compete at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Thursday and Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time coverage on Golf Channel. And then Saturday and Sunday, starts on Golf Channel at 12:30 and then picks up at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time on NBC. When Golf Today rolls on, we're shifting our focus to the LPGA Tour as Lydia Ko is picking up right where she left off in 2024 by spending time in the winner's circle. Beth Ann Nichols is set to join to give her thoughts on what's next for Lydia and can she compete the career Grand Slam.
Back at it on Golf Today. Sunday in Singapore, Lydia Ko carding a final round 69 to win the HSBC Women's World Championship by four for her 23rd career victory on the LPGA Tour. With the win, Ko passing Kari Webb on the career official money list, trailing only Annika Sørenstam. Lydia Ko with those 23 career victories, three more than any other player since the beginning of the 2012 season. MB Park ranked second in that time span with 20, followed by Jin Young Ko and Nelly Korda.
we probably needed to make this next graphic with smaller print, because that is a Hall of Fame career by any stretch of the imagination. 23 LPGA Tour wins, including 3 major championships. The part that blows me away, I call that the podium slam. A gold, a silver, and bronze in the Olympics. Very impressive from start to finish. She was also the first player to get to number one in the Rolex rankings at age 17. Now let's welcome Beth Ann Nichols. Beth Ann, you cover her, Lydia, as much as anyone else. What were your takeaways from this weekend at the HSBC?
Well, I think, first of all, just listening to her talk about how much fun she's having, I've really decided I have absolutely no idea how long she's going to keep playing. It just seems like her perspective is fantastic, as well as her short game, quite obviously. She was very patient in that final round. But, you know, when I look at what Lydia has meant to the game, and I think about Lorena walking away, at the same age as Lydia Ko, actually, in 2010, and the hole that left in the LPGA, I'm just so excited that she's so excited about staying around, and she has these bigger long-term goals that she's still chasing.
Speaking of those bigger long-term goals, with the levels she's playing at, it seems like she's reaching a second peak in her career. She has those 3 different majors on her resume. The LPGA Tour saying a 4th would mean a career grand slam, a 5th would be the super slam, but Beth Ann, it doesn't seem that simple, does it?
Right. You know, this became a thing when we were trying to decide what it meant for NB Park, you know, back in 2015 after she won her 4th different major. And, you know, the LPGA came down and said, you know, we added a 5th major to give more opportunities for our players, but not to make it harder to achieve the grand slam or the career grand slam. So, you know, I asked Lydia, what do you think you need to do to achieve the career grand slam? And she thinks, in her books, she said she needs to win all 5. So that means she needs to win the U.S. Women's Open still and the KPMG Women's PGA. And I tend to agree with her, guys. I feel like, you know, you got to sweep them all to technically have the slam.
That makes a very high bar, but I think I agree with you as well, Beth Ann. When you go back to last year in Paris during the Olympics, there was a lot of rumors swirling that if she were to win the gold and get into the World Golf Hall of Fame, that maybe retirement was on the horizon. I know you just touched on the idea, but has that changed over the last, 6 months? Does she seem like she's refocused on continuing to play?
I definitely think so. You know, she has these 2 majors circled on her calendar and starred and probably highlighted, and she just seems really focused and playing with a newfound sense of freedom. You know, she pointed to, you know, her start in Bradenton, where she said it was one of the worst starts of her career. I think she was like 7 over par after 6 holes or something pretty bad like that. And she was able to find something on the golf course, turn it around, make the cut. And you know, she's been taking that same feel, that same thought, you know, with her on into Singapore. And so, you know, I just feel like she's doing things from a simple approach, really, and giving herself a little bit of leash, realizing that, you know, this is sort of the cherry on the top, everything from now on, you know? And so I think that's a lot of fun, right? Mm-hmm.
Beth Ann, many moons ago, I was a sports anchor in Tucson, Arizona, covering the University of Arizona Pac-12 athletics. And I remember Larry Scott during his time as what was then the Pac-12 as commissioner. What's the latest on the LPGA Tour commissioner search, and is Larry Scott, is that a real possibility?
I think it is. You know, in talking to some folks, it's not just Annika Sorenstam who thinks it's a good idea. You know, I have a lot of questions. I hope the search committee has a lot of questions for Larry Scott. You know, I think when you look at his tenure at the WTA as CEO, what he did in terms of increasing the amount of money the players were competing for, equal pay at 2 of the grand slams, having the men and women share the same stage a whole lot more often. He did a great job, you know, taking advantage of the Williams sisters in terms of their exploding popularity. And so, you know, I definitely think that when you look at tennis, you see a lot of parallels with golf and think, wow, what could he do? But then when you know, that was 15 years ago, what's he done since? And you look at the Pac-12, and there are an awful lot of people, whether it's right or wrong, who look at Larry Scott as the beginning of the end for the Pac-12 and many of the decisions that he made, particularly around the Pac-12 network and the way he lavishly spent money. So, you know, when I look at the position that the LPGA is in right now, yes, they need a visionary. Yes, they need somebody who can really shake things up and really showcase the talent that the tour has right now. But they also are in a precarious spot financially and have to have somebody who can take risks without, you know, without tanking everything. You know, you've got to be able to have a balance there. And so I really hope that the search committee does their research here.
Now, I really want to drill down on this. You pointed out there is a search committee. I'm sure there's a list of things they're looking for in the new commissioner. But what attribute do you think is on top of that list? What's the most important thing they're looking for right now?
Well, I think they need someone who can, you know, gain exposure for the tour, you know, get sponsorship dollars across the finish line. The tour finished in the negative, you know, by about $2 million last year, and the loss of JTBC in terms of paying their bills. Now, obviously, they're going to litigate that in court, but that was a lot of money that the LPGA did not, you know, have coming in. And so, you know, they need someone who can close deals. And I think, you know, that makes Larry Scott attractive when you look at the fact that he comes with a big Rolodex, that he has closed deals in the past, both at the WTA and the Pac-12. But, you know, the media landscape is ever changing and a big question mark. And while he has some wins in that, he also has a major loss in what he did with the Pac-12 network, the gamble that he took there that didn't pay off. And so I think, you know, they really have to look hard at that.
Yeah, and that gamble was to have 100% ownership of the Pac-12 network versus the Big Ten network was half owned by Fox, half owned by the Big Ten Conference. So they had a broadcast partner kind of in place, which was one that, yeah, was a failure over time for sure. Beth Ann, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Here's a look at the upcoming LPGA Tour schedule. They continue their swing through Asia. Blue Bay LPGA this week, and then they're back stateside. Ford Champ presented by Wild Horse Pass end of March. And then things really heat up, starting with the T-Mobile Match Play presented by MGM Rewards first week of April. All that leads up to the season's first major with the Chevron Championship in the end of April. Still to come on Golf Today, we're going to head back to O-Town for this week's signature event. Maverick McNealy is on set to join us. How a win last fall has set Mav up for a good year in 2025, and what are his thoughts on what's next for the PGA Tour?
The top 10 FedEx point earners through the Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches will earn spots in the Arnold Palmer Invitational presented by MasterCard via the Aon Next 10. One of those players is Maverick McNealy. There you see him winning last year in the fall at the RSM Classic, and he's gotten off to a solid start this season. He tied for eighth to open the year at the Century, T9 at the Phoenix Open, and then played really well a few weeks ago. Torrey Pines finishing second at the Genesis Invitational.
How about that? Three top tens and six starts. Just, they say trends are your friends. Based on that win last year at the RSM, he's continuing to play at a really high level, Rex.
And I don't think we can discount confidence when it comes to Mav. And we want to welcome Mav in right now from Bay Hill. Mav, thank you so much for joining us. We want to talk about your season. Before we get to that, I want to go back to 2016 when you played in the Arnold Palmer Invitational as an amateur. You had a chance to meet the king. Can you go back and remember that experience and tell us what that was like?
It was one of the coolest weeks ever. I think if there's a player, I'd be hard-pressed to find a player that was more influential in shaping my professional career than Mr. Palmer. I was really lucky to get to spend some time with him, but I think the coolest experience was here on Friday in 2016. I was paired with Ryan Ruffles and Sam Saunders, and we were the last group off finishing the front nine. They were pulling the flags out behind us, and Mr. Palmer followed us in his golf cart, just driving down the fairways and watching us play. It was something I'll never forget.
That's the absolute best. And how familiar are you with Mr. Palmer's backstory of being the pro that was also the pilot that would fly himself week to week? And obviously, you've recently got your pilot's license that's been very well publicized, how you've been able to travel to events as well.
Mr. Palmer flew a lot faster and a lot cooler plane than I am right now, but maybe keep playing well, I can upgrade down the line. But it's just another reason why he's one of the coolest players to ever play this game. And aviation is definitely a passion of mine for sure.
You mentioned back in 2016 in that story about Arnold Palmer that you actually had a stack of notes that he had sent you. It's something you've picked up. You send notes to people throughout the year. I've been lucky enough to get a couple of those notes. What else did you pick up from the King that you've carried forward in your career?
There's so many things that he did to treat fans and media and everyone around him the right way. I think it just shows how he's a great example of how us as professionals should be grateful for what we get to do. And I have the coolest job in the world, and people like Mr. Palmer paved the way for that, and I realized that, and I want to thank the people that make that possible. And a handwritten note goes a long way. Things like making your signature legible so that if you sign an autograph for a kid, they go home, they know who signed it, and have something to show for that. And just enjoying the game, playing golf to be an entertainer, but also playing to be a great competitor. And, you know, I'd love to drive the ball like him someday.
Matt, we've seen the results over the past 4 or 5 months. It seems like it's been the culmination of a lot of hard work to get to this point. Was this the gradual next step for you, or was there anything substantive that has changed to get you to this point?
I think it's a little bit of both. My best friend at my wedding in December toasted me, and he said, well, you know, with that win, it took you about 15 years to become an overnight success, and there's definitely some truth to that. I owe a lot of credit to my team, because I think the hardest thing in golf is knowing what to work on. Everyone out here, you know, everyone behind me is putting in the work, but the hardest question is to figure out what you need to do to improve. And my team's really been pointing me the right direction. You know, having my wife traveling with me and not being alone in the hotel rooms has been a nice mental reset and fun the last year and a half. Scouts helped me a ton on the bag. My brother and Scott Hamilton got me swinging it the right way. And just everyone's chipping in and working hard, and I'm really grateful for the direction they're giving me.
Mav, I know I've talked to you about this before, but you are on the Player Advisory Council and you're running for chairman, which means if you're elected, you're going to be on the policy board next year. When you look at everything that has transpired over the last few weeks, not one but two meetings in the White House between some policy board members and the President of the United States, why did you feel like it was important to do that now?
There's so much changing in the game right now, and I know it's going to be a bigger time commitment than even I anticipate, but it was my wife, Maya, who told me that I need to get in there and do it, and if there was a time to be able to make an impact, it's now with so much changing in the game. And I've been every step of the way, from a Korn Ferry Tour player to a rookie to a guy playing whenever I got in to now playing in signature events, so I'd like to think I've got a pretty balanced background as to what the PGA Tour player experience is like. And I love this tour, I love my job, and I want what's best for everyone out here.
Mav, thanks to that runner-up at the Genesis, you're all the way up to 12th in the official world golf ranking. You're one behind Bryson DeChambeau, who's 11th, one ahead of Patrick Cantlay, who's 13th. At this moment, do you feel like the 12th best player in the world?
I've been asked this question a couple times, and I know Sahib had a pretty insightful answer that, you know, it's weird to think that I'm number 12 in the world ranking. And I think the reason why it doesn't quite feel like that is I definitely don't have the 12th best resume out here. And I've just very recently gotten there. Recent golf has been really good, but there's still a lot that I want to accomplish in the next 5 to 10 years or however long my career is. And I definitely don't think I've got the 12th best resume on this range right now, but the play as of late has been pretty good, so I think that's might be why it's feeling a little weird.
Matt, if I can go back to last fall when you won the RSM Classic, has anything felt different, maybe when you show up at tournaments? Do you have a little bit more spring in your step? Is there a little bit more confidence? Has that helped?
Definitely there's confidence. I've always been a guy where the confidence is earned. It's not like I can just stand up there and think that I'm the best player. I kind of have to prove it to myself along the way. And being able to execute some really high pressure shots in that situation, coming down 18, gave me a lot of confidence in my process and in my routine, and that why would I do anything different than what's gotten me to this point. So, but like I said, we've just been building. You know, every week we're tweaking and trying to get things a little bit better, and I'm leaning heavily on my team to keep guiding me in the right direction.
With the win, where you're at in the world rank, I mean, you can basically set your schedule for the rest of the year. How do you approach goal setting, either at the beginning of the year or week to week?
I'm very much short-sighted in terms of my goal setting. Things that I want to accomplish in the next month or two, things that I do daily. Scout, my brother, my caddy, is very aggressive when it comes to goal setting, and he sets some goals that are even higher than way higher than what I would have set for myself. And the thought process is, if you set your goals really, really high and you just miss them, you're still going to have an amazing year. So why not come out here and try to be the best we can be and skip as many steps as possible, I guess, if that makes sense. And, you know, I think winning at RSM and the big jump we made, finishing second at Genesis, were, you know, kind of signs that you can take bigger steps than maybe I thought previously.
I know this is so far away and you like to stay in the moment, but talking about goals, where does the Ryder Cup rank on there? And what would that mean if you were able to make that U.S. team?
The Ryder Cup is a career goal of mine, but I think as far as this year goes, my goal isn't to just make the Ryder Cup team. It has to be. I want to win points at Bethpage, and if I'm the right guy for the job, I would love to be there. I will work really hard. I'm really excited to bring my putter to match play because I feel like I'm in every hole until the very end, and I'm just going to keep working really hard and improving and see how good I can get, and if I'm the right guy for the job, I'm going to do everything I can to put up a bunch of points.
Matt, thank you so much for your time, and keep up the pace.
You got it. Thank you, guys.
All right. When Golf Today returns, we're looking back at some of the best memories of Arnold Palmer. And we'll be joined by someone who had a very special connection with the King, Robert Dameron. He gives us some of the best stories of Arnie on the other side of this break.
Just a gentle reminder, live first-round coverage of the Arnold Palmer Invitational presented by MasterCard begins Thursday at 2 Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. One of the signature sites on property at Bay Hill, the statue of Arnold Palmer. This was unveiled back in 2018. The King passed away in 2016, and this week marks the ninth playing of his event without him. But his legacy lives on as everyone is thinking about Mr. Palmer this week. Someone who shared a very special connection with Mr. Palmer, it's Robert Dameron. And Robert, I know the Dameron family moved from Kentucky to Florida, be part of Bay Hill Club and Lodge. On your way to earning a PGA Tour card, you played many rounds with the King. What was the advice that he gave you, like, along the way?
I wasn't smart enough to figure it out until well after I was done playing and he was gone, you know. He was a very simple player. He really played golf out of love of the sport and absolute desire to kick your butt. He was so competitive, but he loved golf as much as breathing. And so really, his approach to the golf, you know, when he played golf, was super simple. He said, really, all I think about, and this is nuts, I'm telling you the truth, all I ever thought about, every important shot, every easy shot, every shot on the range, was my left thumb. And I wanted to make sure that my left thumb didn't get too far on the strong side of the grip because I tended to hook it. So if my left thumb is on top of the grip and not over on the strong side, I know I can hit my little draw without worry of losing it left. And I'm like, wait a minute, you played your whole career. He goes from U.S. amateur to right now, which he was probably 80 at the time he told me. That's my thought on every shot I ever hit. I go, that is insanely simple. But that's the way he did it. And like I said, my young brain at the time, you know, couldn't comprehend that. And it's not that left thumb would have worked for me, but he wanted me to find something simple that I could trust for the rest of my life. And a microphone is the simplest thing I can trust right now.
For those of us who never had the opportunity to sit in that locker room and hear the stories and see Arnold Palmer be the maximum Arnold Palmer, can you give us one of those stories?
In the locker room?
Sure.
Those are probably not for on air, you know. There are a lot of things. He always, I will tell you this, he always, to me and my brother, my younger brother, who was a professional and played on Korn Ferry, he was always asking, what can I do for you? How can I help you out? You know, is there anything where you need help with a sponsor, with a golf tournament, anything you want? And, you know, we always said no. I didn't want to take advantage much, but he was very sincere. And I will give you a couple, you know, great things he did for the Dameron family. One, he got me into my first, I've told this story on Golf Channel before, he got me into my first tournament. I got on tour, got through Q School, but I wasn't in the Bob Hope at the time, the American Express. And I said, Mr. Palmer, I'd love to get in that first tournament. And, you know, you're a big deal everywhere, but Palm Springs especially. So he goes, let me make a call, see what I can do. They didn't have any spots when they called back and said, I'm sorry. That's no problem. The next day, we're playing in the shootout. I'm playing in the group behind Mr. Palmer, and on the third hole, there's a note in the cup. And I looked in there, and I pulled it out, and it says, Robert, you're in the Hope. Call Mike Milthorpe, who was the tournament director at the time. So that's how I found out I got in that tournament. I made 16,000 and got shuffled up and never had to worry about my card again for 10 years. So that was huge. And another one, guys, it was fantastic. My younger brother played. He wasn't, he was kind of done with playing. He played Corn Ferry and he realized it was about time to get a job. He was going to leave here and move to Kentucky, where we're from. And he sent in a resignation letter of his membership. And like a day before my brother Patrick left, Mr. Palmer saw him. He goes, "Hey, I saw that letter that you wrote resigning your membership. I tore it up. You're always a member for life. Anytime you come back, just take care of your stuff, but you never have to not be part of Bay Hill." So he treated the Dameron family very, very well.
That's pretty amazing. And your career, I mean, you mentioned that first start he got you. You made 331 starts on the PGA Tour. What was Bay Hill week like for you? How did it hit different?
Well, Bay Hill is the reason I always wanted to be a professional golfer. We moved here in 1979. That was the first year that the Citrus Classic moved to Bay Hill. And this was my Christmas. It's still my Christmas, frankly. I love this week. I love seeing what's going on. Playing, walking with a microphone, or walking outside the ropes as a kid, I loved every minute of it. So I always wanted to be part of professional golf and doing what these guys I was watching when I'm 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. So when I got my first start into Bay Hill, that was the most nervous, and it's not even close. It frankly isn't close. I kind of remember seeing like all white, like I couldn't focus. My chest hurt for about three holes, and somehow I parred the first three and had a decent tournament, and I don't know how I did it. But this tournament itself, I mean, I owe everything, you know, job-wise to Arnold Palmer. He got me on with you guys at Golf Channel because of his, relationship there, and he helped me get on tour. So everything professionally I've got, I owe to Mr. Palmer.
Now, I don't think anybody knows the evolution of that golf course better than you right now. You have seen it evolve over the years. Certainly Arnold Palmer was constantly tinkering with the golf course. One of those changes this year I wanted to ask you about, that 17, they've essentially done away with that beach area that's short and right of the green. What do you make of that?
Visually, it's shocking to me just because I'm used to seeing it the other way, because the front bunker, it defines the hole from back on the back tee. You could really see it. It made the front edge of the green kind of pop out, and it made the target, I think, a little more clear. Now it's just a bank. It's not like 12 at Augusta shaved down where it's going to bounce back in, but it could bounce back in. So what I think is going to happen is when they start to get, it's this weekend, and they start moving the pin over on the right side, instead of challenging the flagstick, which, okay, if I don't quite make it and it goes in the bunker, fine, I can get that up and down. I think because there's a chance it hits short and jumps back in the water, that you're going to see more guys playing long and left. I'm going to reserve any judgment till after the tournament to see how it plays, but it's still shocking for me to see it.
Robert, seems like in recent years as a signature event, it's been a single-digit winning score, just an absolute grind of a week. What's your forecast coming into this year's edition based on what you're seeing with the course and the weather forecast?
Well, first and foremost, that's the way Mr. Palmer wanted it. Year that Scotty won and the year Tyrrell Hatton won, the greens had gotten baked and the wind was whipping and it was single digits and people were shooting, near 80, some of them, if you weren't playing well. That's the way he wants it. He didn't want these guys coming and ripping apart his golf course. He wanted it to be a true challenge, and I see no reason that it's not going to be that again this week. I haven't seen the forecast beyond Wednesday, so I don't know about the wind, but the rough is grotesque. It's so deep, it's hard to put into words. I played in the Pro-Am yesterday. I tried to chop a 9-iron out of the rough. I moved it about 3 feet maybe in front of me, and just kind of had to laugh it off. That's just the way it is. That's why I don't play anymore, frankly. But I think the greens weren't firm, but they're going to firm up. Because this is yesterday, Thursday's a long way away, so they're going to firm up, and it's going to play in a manner that Mr. Palmer would be proud. And if we get double digits, I would be shocked. I'd say 8-under wins this tournament.
Robert, we just had Mav on talking about the legacy that he learned from Mr. Palmer. There's a whole generation of PGA Tour players that never had the opportunity to meet the king. If there was one thing that those players could take forward that he did best, what would you want that to be?
Oh, that's easy, and that's the way he treated people. Not his people, not the players necessarily, even though he's good to them too, but everyone. And we know the stories, guys, and we've all heard them, and you guys have met him, and you know how he was. But if you got an autograph, or if you got lucky enough to come in the locker room and he was sitting there having a drink or just after a round of golf, and you got to meet him, he would stand up, shake your hand, look you in the eye, and he had a gift that every person that met him, even if they met him for 30 seconds, left feeling like they had just made a friend. He had just a knack that was unbelievable. And so if you can just take that time to look people in the eye, stand up if they see you at dinner and they want to shake your hand, stand up, shake their hand, look them in the eye, thank you so much for being a fan, we appreciate it. It goes a lot longer than people think. And again, it's one of those lessons, not that I needed to sign a whole lot of autographs or shake a whole lot of hands, nothing compared to him, but it's something that resonates as I get older, you know, and the once in the blue moon that somebody does, you know, see me, I remember Mr. Ballmer, I stand up, shake their hand, and try to essentially make a friend.
Robert, thank you so much for your time and enjoy this week. I know it's special for you.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys.